in between services. And I started to say to him, you know, my favorite part of the show last night, and then I stopped myself. I'm like, I found myself saying my favorite part like 5-6 different times, because I think of one favorite part, and then I think of another favorite part, and that was one of my favorite parts, Zach and Greta singing that song. And I talked to the cast briefly before the show, and I don't know if any of them heard me. I know I barely heard what I was saying because we were all sort of getting ready. It was in those tense final moments as we were getting ready and, you know, down in the fellowship hall wondering, is this going to work? Like, I don't know about you guys, but, you know, we had run through it twice before the actual show, and We were a little nervous, I have to say. So we're gathered in this place, and I talked about that song in particular, because that's a moment in the show where Dino is playing Jesus, and he's the three of them are here, and Greta and Zach are singing to him. And the rest of the cast, all of us that were other followers of Jesus, we weren't really any particular role or disciples. We didn't have names necessarily. We were just us there gathered. But it was the part of the show where we're supposed to realize, and Aaron talked about this, that we're in this together, that we've had this community building, and we've had this fun, and we've sang some songs, but at the start of Act 2, things start to get a little dicey, and the Pharisees show up, and there's some trials, and we can tell this Judas guy who had been our friend, who was leading the way at first, and now sort of not really getting it. And he and Jesus have this song where they're singing, and it's easy to think that Judas is singing about justice, but really he's just singing about jealousy. And Jesus is singing about, you know, the things that really matter in life. But all of us were supposed to feel this moment where we're going to do this discipleship thing. We're following you, Jesus. This is the moment. We're deciding, yeah, we're following you. We may not know where it's going to go. We don't know what's going to, but we're going to follow you. All we know is in this moment right now, we've got each other and we've got you. And we're going to do this together. And that's part of what makes the sadness of Judas's decision so much more. Because this is the moment in the show where he decides he's going to betray Jesus. When everyone else says, yeah, we're in this. We don't know. It's a little bit scary. And it talks about the pebble that's called dare. Because there's something about following Christ that's daring, that's scary, that takes a little bit of a risk, and it's in your shoe, and it's kind of annoying sometimes. Following Christ can be annoying. It can be kind of a pain because it makes you think of things and see things in ways that you don't want to think of things or see things. Following Christ makes you not be able to be apathetic anymore. It makes you not be able to be ignorant anymore. It makes you open your eyes to the world. And it's daring, and it's scary, and sometimes it's uncomfortable, but we're deciding in that moment we're going to follow. And for good reason. This Jesus, with his disciples, they'd been through a lot together. And they didn't know where the road was going exactly. And the truth of the matter is, the disciples in the show and the real disciples that followed Jesus in the scripture story, they had good intentions, but they didn't quite follow the way they thought they would. Peter denies Jesus. Of course, Judas betrays him, but Peter denies Jesus, and the rest of the disciples abandon him, and they run away scared and afraid. That's a tough reality. That was true of the disciples then, but it's true of so many of us now, even as we who call ourselves Christ, as we follow Jesus, as we're trying to follow, and we've got that pebble in our shoe, it's really easy sometimes to just want to take it out or ignore it or pretend like it didn't happen. But yet there's something that compels us to keep going, to keep trying, to keep walking. And I think it's because we, you understand that the love of Christ is so compelling, so powerful, that you remember other moments. You remember the good times. You remember the times when Jesus has picked you up and strengthened you and given you power and peace. And those times of struggle become times of endurance. Because above all, Jesus loved. And he offered that love to other people. And in this world, there's a lot of ways that people try to be leaders. They try to lead, you know, Jesus led with love, but there's a lot of other ways of modeling leadership in this world, and we've all experienced different kinds. And one model of leadership has made a lot of headlines this week. One model of teaching, and I hate even calling it teaching. A guy named Mike Rice made some headlines. He was a coach at Rutgers University. And it was revealed this week that his idea of leadership, his idea of inspiration, and his idea of motivation was to berate people and abuse them and yell and scream and go beyond just yelling and screaming and start to get physical. And there's video that came out that showed him pushing guys and throwing and like whipping basketballs at people and kicking his players and just treating them with no respect and no dignity, no love. That's not how you treat somebody you love. It was an abusive relationship. And these poor players, these young men who looked up to this guy, and he controlled so much of their livelihood, so much of their life. I mean, they were there on scholarship because he allowed them to be. We're in this abusive relationship, and they didn't see any way out. And luckily, the video came out, and people spoke up. And the guy and Mike Rice ended up getting fired. And now another athletic director has been fired because he saw this video and he thought, well, suspension's enough. But we can leave this abusive man in control and in a position of leadership over these young men. And myself, as I watched this video over the week and I saw it over, and I watch a lot of ESPN, so I saw this video over and over again, and it was hard because I was a basketball player. I was on basketball teams. I was in practices on football fields and courts and all sorts of play. I've spent my life on teams, and I've had coaches. And I had coaches that I loved that I would run through a wall for. And I had coaches that, while they weren't Mike Rice, they weren't exactly caring either. And as I was reading, learning more about this and thinking about what it was like to be yelled at and to be treated like you were less than precious, like you were less than a child of God, how awful that feels. And it doesn't just, you don't have to be on a team and have a bad coach to have someone treat you like that. It can happen at work. It can happen in a family of all places. And how horrible that is when a family, a place that should be a place of shelter, a place of comfort, when a family can become that place where you're abused, and how horrible and how heartbreaking that really is. And I was reading more, and I heard, in the course of my reading, I came across this statistic, and it's one of those things, I'm not sure what they were citing, but they had heard, and I don't know how you study something like this, but according to child psychologists, I think even if the numbers aren't exactly right, I think the idea holds true that with a child, every time you criticize or sort of, you know, insult seems like too strong of a word, but anytime you say something negative to a child one time, it takes 10 praises to like build back that child up to the same level of confidence that they had before that one criticism. That 10-to-1 ratio, and I don't know how you come up with something like that, but I think it resonates because I think we all know that how hard it is, how much an insult hurts. You know, I know, 10 people can say, great job, but one person says, eh, and you dwell on that eh for ages. And that's, I'm a full-grown man, But for children, how hard that is. And I read one interpreter say that the way they understand this is children become what you call them. Yeah. Children become what you call them. I wish I could take credit for that, but children become what you call them. That resonated with me. It resonates with how I treat my daughters. It resonates with how I treat our young people. It resonates with how I treat other people. You become what you are called. You become what you're named. And if you are called less than a child of God, you start to believe it. And what a terrible tragedy that is. That there are children, there are people out there that believe they're anything less than beautiful. And then I'm thinking about Jesus, this man that offered love, that offered life, that offered healing and broke divisions and did all these wonderful things. And he shared this Sermon on the Mount, this couple chapters in Matthew. And if you're only going to read two chapters in the whole Bible, make them Matthew 5 and 6. It's Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapters 5 and 6. You know, it's all good. You know, you should read all of it. Don't say, Pastor Rob said, don't read the Bible. Read it, but if you're going to start somewhere, or if you only got time, if you want, you know, to get down to the heart of the matter, read Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapters 5 and 6. And it's here where Jesus gathers with the crowds and he says these words, "You are the light of the world. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world." Jesus said this. I think he knew what child psychiatrists know now. He didn't need a study. He knew that people become what they're called. You are the light of the world. You are the salt of the earth. So let's look a little bit more about what that means. What does it mean to be the light of the world? What would it have meant to the people that heard it for this first time? What is light? You know, we kind of think of, okay, well, light, that's good. We want to be light, right? We understand the symbolism of light and darkness. It's not a real complicated thing. But when you think about it, really, when you think of Genesis, how the Bible starts, in the beginning there was darkness, there was chaos, there was this formless void. And the beginning of creation, God said, "Let there be light." From the very moment of creation, from the beginning of who God was, when God created this thing we call the universe, when God made everything, God started with light. It was the beginning of everything. And God put his heart, his mind, his everything into this, the breath of life, and he called it light. You are the light of the world. And later, this idea of what light is gets lifted up more and more in the Psalms. It talks about light. That light is, that thy word is a light unto my path. Light shining through this path, giving us a way, showing the way in the darkness. You know, we talk about, people have heard about the valley of the shadow of death. But there's no shadow without light. There's no valley without peak. The book of Isaiah is soaked in this imagery of light, and it talks about the suffering servant that would be the light to the nations. So the people of Israel, the Hebrews, they understood, these people that would have been listening to Jesus, understood what it meant to be the light of the world. They understood what it was to be the light of the nations. This was not a new concept. But Israel was the light of the nations. They understood this, that the God's chosen people, they were blessed through Abraham to be a blessing to the world. That they were chosen for a reason and for a purpose. They understood this idea that as a people we would be the light to the nations. But here Jesus is saying, "You are the light of the world." Huh. And you're the salt of the earth. Now, we've heard that phrase. That's one of those things that's kind of picked up meaning in our modern language, that you're the salt of the earth. And usually when we say someone's the salt of the earth, we mean they're someone that's sort of just a good guy, right? A good dude, you know, normal, simple, plain, you know, just you're salt of the earth. Not a lot of frills, not a lot of pomp and circumstance. And that's wonderful. It's a wonderful way of thinking about it. But what is salt? I mean, salt is on the table next to the pepper. You sprinkle it on food. I mean, my doctor says to avoid salt, right? I mean, so many of us aren't supposed to have salt because it raises your blood pressure, and that's a problem, so we want to avoid salt. But salt is, I read, I don't know if this is true, I haven't thought about it that much, but I read somewhere that salt is the only rock we eat. I thought that was kind of funny. It's this thing that's so much more than just in the salt shaker on the table. Salt for ancient peoples, and even still today, any chef knows that sprinkling some salt on the meal at the end is totally different from cooking it into the food as you go. That the proper use of salt isn't just as a second thought after you've cooked the meal. That it's too late for salt to really work then. Salt, you really have to do it as you go. You got to salt the meat first before you put it in the oil. And then you got the tomatoes and the garlic, and then you add a little bit more salt, and it's all got to simmer in there. And the salt makes it special. And it's part of it's integrated into everything. And for ancient peoples, that understanding was true too. The salt was something that you embed into special meals. It was rare. It was hard to find. It was so valuable. You didn't just sprinkle it on things every once in a while. It was used for special occasions. If you wanted to make a meal special, that's when you use salt. So the salt is something to be cherished, something to be for celebration, for joy. This is what salt was. But more than this, it wasn't just for celebration and joy. It was essential to life. Salt has this amazing property of drawing out moisture. And they discovered thousands of years ago that if you soaked something in salt water, in a brine, if you soaked a vegetable, it would be preserved, and you could save it then for a long period of time. You could do the same with meat. If you salted meat, it would last for a really long time. And so if you had a kill and you needed meat, you couldn't eat the whole thing at one setting, and it would rot within a few days. But salt gave you life. Salt gave you food for months. So salt was, I mean, it's been theorized, there's a book called Salt, the History of the World, that without salt, there's no civilization. Because it gave people a chance to store food, it gave people a chance to come together, it gave people a chance to really gather as communities and towns and make something of themselves, and make something more than just surviving day to day. Okay, so salt means something a little bit more, huh? You're the salt of the world. Well, and more than this, salt was used in, it was so important. It's in other parts in the Old Testament. In the Hebrew Bible, there's other parts about priests using salts as in worship, combining salts and spices and oils to help create worship rituals. It was used for covenants when people came together and shared a covenant, a contract. Sprinkling salt was a way to bind that agreement. To bind covenants together. You're the salt of the earth. It starts to mean a little bit more. And Jesus gathered with these people, these crowds, on the Sermon on the Mount. And he told them, "You are the salt of the earth." Jesus knew that we become what we're called. We weren't ready. They weren't ready at that moment. They weren't ready. They didn't. I don't know if they got it at the moment you hear it. And even if the first time you hear something like that, I don't know if any of us really get it necessarily. I mean, that's big to have Jesus calling us the salt of the earth, the light of the world. What does that mean? I'm the light of the world. The world's really big. And I'm not light. I've seen my darkness. I know my darkness way too well to think I could possibly be the light of the world. And the disciples, they heard these words, and I don't know if they really got, they got it, but at the same time, they didn't. Because the gospel stories are full of the disciples not getting it, of understanding and following and loving what they're hearing and being ready to follow and being willing and yet at the same time struggling and not getting it and falling into the water and not quite getting it and rushing, giving wrong answers and then, of course, denying and betraying. Falling away, falling asleep. And yet, hearing those words can change you. Last night, someone came up to me and told me, and I didn't share this at the first service, so listen up, guys, because I didn't know this happened. Somebody came up, and I was talking with this woman, and she said, you know, I'd had this Godspell playbill for years. It was an original New York playbill. She's like, I don't even necessarily remember how I got it, and an old album with a cover, and I've always seen the picture, and I've never really known what it was. I've never listened to it. I don't think she probably didn't even have a record player. She didn't know what it was, but then she heard, saw on the paper that we were doing Godspell. So she thought, well, maybe I'll go. That would be neat. I wonder what this thing is that I've had with me for all these years. I've had this thing. Maybe I'll go see what it is. I don't know. And she came last night, and after the show, she thanked me. That it was so great. She said, I had such a good time. It was so much fun. The song, the music was so great. I'm so glad that I was here tonight. And I said, I'm glad you're here too. That's great. Thanks for telling me that, you know. And I said, you know, if we're going to sing the songs again tomorrow, you know, you can come back, and we'll worship together. And in case you're wondering, I don't see her here, so that's not the twist end. But that doesn't really matter. That the idea that, you know, there was an invitation offered, and this person that said that she had a great time that wouldn't have known it, and I was really excited. You know, it was great that we were here together for the show, and there were so many people and so many of our church family, and so many memories of Tina, you know, singing to Ed and to Werner and when Bill grabbed her. I mean, I just died when that happened. You know, so many memories of when we're all together, and it was so much fun. But this having this thing that there was someone there that hadn't known about it, and there was this invitation extended. It was so wonderful. And I was telling this to Tom, and I kind of described her a little bit. And he said, oh, yeah, I saw her at intermission. And she was looking for some bake sale, some treats. And so I talked to her, and Tom said, I remember you. You're the light of the world. And she was one of the people that Dino had picked up that we sang to and said, you are the light of the world, too. There was a part of the show where we sang those words. And Dino, who was playing Jesus, went into the pews, and he grabbed somebody, and he picked somebody up, and had her stand up, and it happened a couple different times. And everyone said, you are the light of the world, and the whole crew then said, you are the light of the world, and then he sat down, and then we went, and there was somebody else, and we pointed to, and you are the salt of the earth, and then she said to Tom, yeah, that was funny. Nobody's ever called me that before. I wonder, in this world, how many people have never been told that they're the light of the world? How many people are there out there? How many children today? How many adults have lived their whole lives and nobody's ever said to them, you are the light of the world. You're the light of my world. And how tragic that is, that there's somebody out there somewhere, maybe sitting here, maybe it's a neighbor, maybe it's a coworker, maybe it's someone that comes in for our community dinner, maybe it's somebody that we serve at the wardrobe, maybe it's somebody that you sit next to on an airplane, or somebody that you go to at the grocery store, maybe it's the waitress that's going to serve you at the table when you go to the Village Inn after church. Maybe it's somebody that has never been told, you are the light of the world. They've never heard that before. And what a tragedy that is. How sad that is that there are people out there in this world that are living in that kind of darkness, that are living in that kind of sadness, that are living in that kind of trap of mourning, of pain. And nobody's ever reached out and said, you are the light of the world. I'm here to tell you, every single one of you that are here, all of you, every single one of you, you are the light of the world. And it's not my words, because nobody cares if I think you are. Jesus Christ, the Son of the Most High, thinks you are the light of the world. You. And you become what you are called. Become what you are called. Be the light of the world. Too many times, I know I've done it. I know I'm the light of the world. I can feel it in my heart, but I'll hide under that bushel. And you know what? That's lost something kind of crucial. When you do that, you've lost something. When you hide it, when you're the salt of the earth and you let yourself be diluted by water, the thing is, salt doesn't lose its flavor. That's what makes salt amazing, is that left on its own, it is the salt and it remains the salt. It only stops being salty if you dilute it. If you let somebody else come in and pour water over your fire, if you let somebody else come in and dilute your passion, that's when you lose your saltiness. If you let your fears and your worries and your hang-ups and all your sins and let all that baggage, if that's the only thing that can dilute your saltiness, you are the salt of the earth. And nothing can take that away from you. So, we're supposed to go right now. Go out and be the light. Go out and be the salt. You know, the disciples didn't get it when he said it there on the mount. The disciples didn't get it when he offered them everything. They didn't even really get it when he went to the cross. They didn't get it. Even when they saw him scourged and they saw the trial and they saw him hanging on the cross, they still didn't really get it. They knew that Jesus had died and they thought that was it. They thought that was the end of the story. They thought that all the things that he had taught them, all the things that he had shown them was wrong. They thought it was all for nothing. And it turns out they were wrong. So, the show's over. The lights are down. The applause is silent. The music is stopped. So now what? I don't know about you guys, but I found myself asking that question last night. And now especially here, because now I really feel like it's over. We move on. We move on to the next audition, the next show. We move on to the next challenge, the next trial, the next day. But we do so knowing that we are changed. We move on knowing that we will never be the same, that what we did will never die. We move on with a new memory, a new joke, a new song in our heart. We move on with more knowledge about ourselves. I know something about myself now that I did not know at 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon. We move on with new friends, with a new community. And we know that the community we formed will never again form in exactly the same way. It won't. And that we mourn. But we also move on with the assurance that the community we formed will be a part of every community we ever form again. For the rest of our lives, this moment will be a part of that. And if you were here, I apologize that I'm talking to these guys. If you were here last night, know that that experience is a part of everything that you are. This moment here, that this community we have formed in this moment, is a part of every community you form for the rest of your lives. So we try to go back to normal. And we find now that normal is changed. It's been changed by the song. It's been changed by the story. It's been changed by the mistakes, the slip-ups, the ad-libs. We're changed by the fed lines and the gentle nudges. We've been changed by the words of encouragement, the pats on the back, the held hands, the shared smiles. We have been changed by friends. We have been changed by love. Above all, we have been changed by the power of God. And isn't that really the story of Easter? When it was all over, when the body was sealed away and the tears had been shed, when the bread was back on the shelf and the stopper was put back on the wine and the world was returning to normal, something happened. Something happened that reminded them that they could never really go back to normal. They tried to walk home, but were stopped on the road by a stranger who they broke bread with. They locked themselves in an upper room and suddenly were confronted with the man they had denied, who offered them peace. They went back to fishing and couldn't catch a thing until they saw him standing there and said, "Cast your net on the other side." And their nets were overflowing. Something happened. And they encountered the Christ who was restored to life. They found an empty tomb. They found the resurrection. They knew that Christ had risen, and they realized that life would never be the same. Everything was changed. They were changed by the song. They were changed by the story. They were changed by the denials, the betrayals, and the scared starry night. They were changed by the sermons, by the healing, by the invitation, by the shared meals. They were changed by their friends. They were changed by love. And they were changed by the power and the grace and the glory of God. And so now we come to this table. We come to the bread and the cup, and we know that when we come to this table, everything has changed. This bread is no longer bread. This juice is no longer juice. Everything is different. We come and we are transformed by the body of Christ, by the redeeming power of Christ's blood. And we know, because Christ told us, and Christ invited us, and Christ said, "I'm there with you," that you are the salt of the earth. And you are the light of the world. So come to my table and eat. Lunch is ready. And then go out into the world and find someone who needs to hear you. You. Are the light of the world.